Now, it was back in 1992 that the author Pat McCabe first brought us the fictional homicidal character of Francie Brady, the butcher boy, set in a small cabin town in the 1960s. Well, now Francie Brady is back in a new book called The Big Yarrow, and although it's set many years later in a mental institution, the same universal themes of loss, fear, religion, violence and humour all make a welcome reappearance. Pat McCabe, good morning. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
I know you're kind of quite clear that this is not a sequel, but your Butcher Boy was nominated for the Booker Prize. There was the movie. For those that weren't born then, can you just give an outline of who we're talking about?
Well, it's very strange when you write a book, really, because most of the time, certainly when I was younger, you sat down, you wrote something, it could be a short story or it could be a piece of drama, and you didn't really expect anything to happen to it. You know, that was generally the kind of state of play for writers at the time. It might be reviewed, it might not, but it certainly didn't occupy, not as far as I could feel anyway, a great significant space at the centre of the culture. I was proven wrong in that then when I'd written this book, which it's interesting, the kind of history, because I had sent it to a publisher. It was written in a kind of stream of consciousness style. Not that that's original, because Joyce and Dujardin and many other people had done it long before I did, but it kind of suited the story I was trying to tell. And you'd say, well, what story were you trying to tell? And there's the question, because you never really know. When it became this extraordinary success, most people's apprehension of the character was that he was a kind of a young punk, you know, that he was a kind of an anarchist, kind of blowing the lid off repressed, institutionalised Ireland, which was the furthest thing from my mind, actually.
Really?
Yes. What the book was about, and I was kind of thinking about this before, because it's a long time since I've spoken about it. The book I was really writing about, or trying to get to the core of, and not that I'm complaining about any success it had, mind you. Not long before I'd started on the draft that became so successful, I had seen David Lynch's Blue Velvet. And having left that feature film, I thought, there isn't any point in writing. Because it was an unqualified masterpiece, and everything that I had been attempting to do in fiction, I suppose, was there on the screen. What do I mean by that? I mean a kind of perfect synthesis of music and image. And a mythic story told through the eyes of a teenage boy, which could be rural Ireland, it could be Minnesota, it didn't make any difference, but certainly I knew that for fiction to have any really important reach at all, it had to inhabit a mythic space, should I say. So politically aligned with that was, how valuable is your own experience? You know, if you come from a small town like Dublin was in the 1900s, or a small town as I did, like Clonus, would anybody really be interested, you know? And it really was a very important political point. And you can only, when a younger person, get to the point of dealing with that, either through massive success or complete failure. And the original draft of The Butcher Boy was a complete and utter abject failure. The couple of publishers had said that perhaps it might be no idea, that I it mightn't be a bad idea if I, like the character I was attempting to create, would perhaps present myself at a hospital of some kind, you know, and maybe stay there for some time and reemerge, you know, as a sane human being. But anyway, the core of this draft was, as I realise now, very influenced, although it was never mentioned in reviews, by David Lynch's Blue Velvet. Why? Well, constantly through everything I've written then and since, there's the omnipresence of snowdrops and robins. I've only just realised this. At the end of Blue Velvet, there's a robin which I think is a clockwork robin chewing a bug. And Cal McLachlan and Laura Dern are in a car, and the music, I think, is Mysteries of Love by Angelo Badalamenti. Laura Dern turns to Cal McLachlan as the music soars and the robin chews the cockroach. Why is there so much sadness in the world? Why in such a beautiful place? Why in such a beautiful place of blue skies, picket fences and beautiful red robins is the heartbreak running concurrently? Now, having said that I would renounce fiction, I haven't seen this.
Somehow,
I didn't, because somehow a memory of this song, I'm getting to the point of your question now, please forgive my digressions, but when I was a boy, a very, very significant thing happened, which would have been described as the Irish Woodstock, which was the precursor to the extraordinary flowering that you now see of Irish traditional music with Ye Vagabonds, you know, Lancome, Lisa O'Neill, all these people. I think this was the grandfather or grandmother of what's happening now. You couldn't see it, but there was a sense that it was a seismic event, even if we didn't know it. It was a, if you're talking about blowing the lid off repressed art, this was it in glorious living black and white, as it were. But anyway, to eventually get to, they heard this girl singing The Butcher Boy. And The Butcher Boy is a song that was sung by every inebriated uncle at every wedding. And we took it all for granted. We took so much of that culture for granted, it kind of is bewildering, actually, looking back on it now. But anyway, to conclude this circumlocutory response to your very valid question, the end of The Butcher Boy lyric is very, very like David Lynch, and the music has the same, it performs the same function. I don't know if there's a robin there, but there's certainly a sense of the natural world coming asunder, a girl putting a rope around her neck, and all the beautiful things in the world, where are they? That was what led me to The Butcher Boy. David Lynch was never mentioned. An awful lot of very kind of incisive reviews mentioned the social aspect of it. At last, someone is telling the story about how awful a country it was. That wasn't how I saw it.
But there was a lot of awfulness in it.
No question.
But just a brief thing. It was about a boy in a town like your own. Very difficult background. A murder. And the consequences that flowed from that. All surrounded by Ireland, religion, fear, happiness, joy, sadness and loss.
Yeah. All
Would
those,
you accept that?
All those things.
Okay. So the he's back. And it's decades later. And actually, before we go into it, you were talking about The Butcher Boy and the song. And you use music to write.
Yeah.
You use three strands in this one. Will we listen to the first one? It's the really cheery one.
Oh, absolutely.
And then tell me.
Yeah. Sugar.
Now, explain to me, said Finn, as they say.
Well, it's interesting that we were talking just now about the flacule, as it was, the beginning of the kind of, I suppose, musical and social revolution that happened in Ireland, maybe about 1964 to 1966. And there was a sense of that period, certainly for young people, of immense possibility in Ireland. I think that this was the pre-Ulster conflict time, where there was a kind of a sense that having established the Republic or attempted to over a period of 40, 50 years, that now it was game on. And there was a huge sense of, with the 1966 commemoration, which is now retrospectively derided as kind of sectarian and so on, which is very debatable, really, and we haven't got the time to go into it now. But how I remember it was a sense of the old guard having, you know, collected their medals and so on, having done something kind of very significant. They knew it. They were being honoured for it. And somehow along with that, there was a sense of the pop culture explosion. And around this time, bubblegum music became very, very popular. It was children's songs, really. And it was a sort of like, it linked in my mind as a sort of a bubblegum party where everybody wants a piece of the jelly, you know. And I have to emphasise this was before the dark clouds of 1967, 60, which you now see on our TV screens being relayed from that dreadful time. But that was yet to happen. So there was a sense that everyone was high on E numbers, like Francie Brady is in the institution in this book and in the original one. You know, and it's a thing that I use all the time without even realising it, actually. It's in Breakfast on Pluto with the Wombles, you know, that kind of minor key, McCartney-esque melodies and kids' music. There's a sort of an innocence, really, that goes along with that. But particularly with the Big Yo-Yo, why this, which is, Yo-Yo, I have to say, you see, is hooray, spelled backwards. You mightn't think that. So you've got two things going along in the Big Yo-Yo, which links with what I was trying to articulate earlier on about the Robins and Snowdrops or the Fall of Icarus or any of these great paintings concurrently with great tragedy. You have unbridled excitement and ecstasy, and it's the nature of life. And the bubblegum jauntiness of pop, the Sugar Sugar, which is arguably one of the most perfect pop singles ever created, you have the cartoon identities of the Archies. They're almost like some kind of netherworld representation of the lovely part of the innocent human soul. So while I could never have explained why I keep playing this song over and over, like... you know, and repeating the Candy Girl references by, you know, the precocious squeaks of Veronica Archie and, you know. At the moment when that song catches fire, it's kind of transcendent almost, and it's like a hymn to human happiness.
Well, it's interesting that it's a hymn to human happiness, because if you take Francie Brady, committed at least one terrible murder, yet you find a place for humour and compassion, and it appears to be important to you to put him in a context and a time that draws us to him.
Mm. Well, it's always kind of difficult when people say you choose to do this or you choose to, you know, move.
You
him,
appear to,
or you appear to. The fact is, there is a great deal of autobiography in it. There isn't a really great distance between the character and me. You know, I think it was Richard Ford might have said, you know, he didn't understand that kind of view, that his characters were galley slaves, that they did what he told them. Well, I would be too afraid to order anyone around. So I kind of hope that somewhere, again, when you kind of surrender, as you do in the great religions of the world, for example, everyone goes down on their knees to submits to a higher authority. And by doing that, sometimes you release, maybe I'm sure there's a physical basis for this, a calm maybe, or certainly a meditative thing, which allows you access to aspects of your back brain or your inner soul, which you may not necessarily have been cognizant of previously. I don't know if there's any real basis in any of that, but that's what it sort of always has seemed to me. When one is writing, why I always write longhand. I think it flows through.
Do you?
Well, it kind of flows through the veins really better for me. Now, that's no prescription, because most people now wouldn't think that was nonsense.
Yeah.
That's fine. Everybody has their own. But anyway, along with these Snowdrops and Robins and everything else, the sheer ecstasy, the beauty of it sometimes is enough to carry him along. And he feeds on this all the time. And it's a protection of some kind, even though it's a kind of a contradiction in terms. If you know that something's going to atrophy, why would you revere it or venerate it? But that's the human condition. And at all times, I was kind of, fiction meant anything. Like I was trying to say that at the beginning, that first of all, you have to decide or figure out in some way how valuable, you know, the dross of your own experience is to the wider world. And I am thinking about the wider world rather than, you know, just a couple of friends. And it must, to some extent, be informed by myth, you know. So there was a kind of, the mythic aspect comes from mostly in the story of the Big Yo-Yo from pop music and the cinema and you know, perhaps.
And comics.
Oh, very much so. There's certainly what would have been called the degraded image, you know, which is possibly the most democratic art form the world has ever known, the cinema and the comic book.
And, well, the comic book refers back to the Butcher Boy as well. But what I found interesting reading this book is how this person, this character, whom one might have expected to be in despair, lived a life of sorts, sometimes with joy, and some fulfilment in a place that might have been expected to be full of hopelessness?
Well, sometimes, you know, I often wonder, like, especially when you're talking about small communities, you know, who decides? You know, seems is a very loaded word. You know, certainly when I was a boy and lived in a small town until I was 17, 18, and still do, but I was away for many years, there was so much excitement that I couldn't contain it. Now, you could say, you know, well, that was your own imagination, or none of this was going on at all, that you know, which is valid too. But again, you know, it's one of the benefits of the creative imagination, I suppose, in that all you need to do to sustain yourself is have a piece of paper and a stub of a pencil. If you're dropped in the Urals, you know, you would ask the question, well, why would you do it? But we could be here till doomsday, kind of trying to answer that one. But the creative impulse is so powerful, whether you're a sculptor or musician or whatever. But with fiction, all you need are the basic materials. And to recast the community in which you are formed and the world, the wider world, it's a very exciting thing to do, you know, sometimes. And very, as I get older now, I kind of, and it fades, it recedes. And there's a very much a sense in the Big Yeru of the sense of the world that formed you receding. And this is not a lament or anything, yeah, but it is an acknowledgement,
yeah,
that the world in which you first drew breath is the most significant world you're ever going to know. It's the place where your name was first spoken. You know, it's the place where you understood how people operated. And, you know, I don't really understand, you know, this simplistic view of small communities, you know. Whether it's Mexico or whether it's Africa.
Yep.
Small communities are the same everywhere.
Kind really. Of a universal
I thing. Think so.
When you talk about your formation, you're receding, and you use the word autobiographical in this. Do you think that, say, for your parents, they would have had a completely different life had they been born now rather than when they were born?
Oh, I have no doubt about it at all. I think the lack of opportunity for that generation, you know, was so stultifying. And you must place it in the context of history, in that if Ireland elects for independence, magnificent a stroke as that is, and how admirable for that extraordinary generation, it's not easy. So you've got an exchequer that's bankrupt, you've got a country that's neutral during the war. We arrived when all that hangover was happening. You know, as George Orwell said, the glow of renunciation doesn't last very long. So in we come, the big hangover, and remember that Irish culture and English culture, for all the problems, were inextricable. You know, listening to the BBC, all those things were, this is a very complicated issue.
And you listen to the radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so music and culture and all those things, whether Irish or English or a mixture of both, you know, my father, for example, didn't have the opportunity to go to university. And that really followed him all his life. Very few people did go to university from that small town. My mother was a beautiful singer, a very fine writer. They knew with big families, this is what people tend to forget now in the world before contraception, how big families were. Mm. You know, it's the famous one, like Billy Connolly, you know, the kid comes in and says, Mom, I can have money for the pictures. And the mother gives him a wallop across the head and sends him flying across the sofa. You know, I'll give you pictures, you and your pictures. And people say, why would they do that? Why are they so cruel? Mainly because the 8 or 9 other kids for whom they had no sixpences to give would be queuing up to get it. So it was an expedient kind of way of dealing with the situation.
Yeah.
So had they lived now, I'm not saying that my father would have ended up in the Brill Building as a fine songwriter, but he might have.
Yeah, it was the potential that wasn't realised.
For a lot of people, men and women, yeah.
So bring me back to Francie. And what happened to him as he progressed on after Butcher Boy now and to where we are now?
Well, I was never really conscious, as you said at the beginning, you know, of writing a sequel or not, but if there's an idea that kind of pursues you, whether it's through music or anything else, it makes you upset if you don't address it. You're constantly kind of complaining, and there's like a stone in your shoe, and eventually you either address the situation. I mean, I didn't want it really to go into the public arena for all the obvious reasons, you know. You could just see a mile away, you know, what a pity this author returned, you know. When it almost tarnishes the... So you have to either, you know, bite that bullet or not. That's a decision every author has made.
Can I bring you to Francie now?
Yeah.
He doesn't talk to the Virgin Mary anymore.
That was kind of why I decided to write it, because it was heartbreaking for me, actually, to have to admit that. Now, there's just a little line from Philip Larkin, if you would bear with me, that kind of triggered that for me, because I wasn't really sure what his state of mind, because he's very intelligent, this character, you know.
Yeah.
He's sophisticated in a way that's not initially maybe discernible. But this poem, Dublin-esque, and I'm not going to read all of it, just a couple of lines, so good to bear with me, but it kind of indicated to me, as this world in which I was formed began to slowly recede, what exactly it meant and, you know, why it was triggering this sense of immense loss within me. And I don't mean sentiment, I mean loss. It's your own mortality you're talking about, really. And it's called Dublin-esque, and it's by the great poet Philip Larkin. Down stucco side streets, where light is pewter and afternoon mist brings lights on in shops, above race guides and rosaries, a funeral passes. There is an air of great friendliness and of great sadness also. As they wend away, the voice is heard singing of Kitty or Katie, as if the name meant once all love, all beauty. And that's where the robins and the snowdrops come in.
Right, right. I want to come on to the thing. Well, there are so many themes in this. We had Sugar Sugar. We now have Emmerdale. Let's listen to this. Now, I went back over that this morning to see what memories it evoked. You tell me, first of all, what that meant to you as music while you were writing the book.
Well, the one thing that I've always been very aware of is not using music solely for sentiment, you know, recruiting it, you know, just to plug a gap. This was something much deeper than that. And as I was playing it over and over, I didn't really investigate it, what it meant, until the book was finished, you know. And when I say that the Francie Brady character is sophisticated, I mean you're unlikely to come across him in the music room playing Rossini's William Tell or Grieg's Peer Gynt. But if you examine what's going on in Emmerdale Farm, the theme, I mean, you have exactly the same as you will find in Peer Gynt or William Tell's Rossini, you know. And when the opening footage of that, it's a helicopter shot that goes over a couple of fields and sort of homes in from about a couple of hundred feet in the air. And it's a kind of almost when he's in this overheated room reflecting on his life as this legato, pastoral sorge, that he's slowly begins to succumb to the desolation of what he's done but doesn't name it. And it's like the helicopter shot as it comes over the churchyard of Emmerdale and has that sort of sweep of the European tradition of pastoral music. It becomes a moorland of a soul, you know. It really becomes like a carbonated, sootish place of a soul which has been, if not destroyed, atomized or tarnished in some awful way. And then again, you see, it surges with this romantic melancholy again, and he has this kind of, these resources to come back bouncing again with Sugar Sugar. That could be self-delusional, right, but that's how he succeeds, and that's why the music keeps, that's why it kept coming back to me.
And it evoked memory for him that was layers of memory, really, and then came back to Uncle Allo's death. Explain to people Uncle Allo's death.
Well, Uncle Allo is the uncle that everybody had in the 60s. He arrives over from London. You know, he's got the old suit on. He's got the red handkerchief. Here's my little fella. How are you, lad? Swings him around. He speaks to him of Manchester United, of what it's like in London. There's a party in the house. What happens is the young boy, again, being so alert to his environment that nothing escapes him, he realises yet again that all the beautiful things in the world are a lie, because he overhears a bitter argument, as often happened in those years, because of the things we've spoken about lack of opportunity. So Uncle Allo in London represents, even though that's an illusion too, the opportunity that the father perhaps might have felt he was denied. Where does that come out? It usually comes out in slander, bitterness and violence often. And what happens is that as the time goes on, Uncle Allo, news reaches Francie that he has died in an old folks' home. That's the Emmerdale Farm theme again, of an overheated room, the surge of the English pastoral, and nobody there. This loneliness thing keeps coming back.
Well, what he realised at the time is all we are in the end is strangers. And that Uncle Allo was there, nobody with him, nobody to hold his hand. Very bleak.
At that moment, but it doesn't stay there. All, you know, it moves on. I mean, there are very few people listening to this program or anywhere on the earth that haven't felt that at some time. But they have resources, you know. In the past it was the church, now it's something else, you know, and it keeps real because people need it. But most of all, what they need is each other, you see. So that sounds a little bit bland, but it's, you know, it's unfortunately it's a fact. And at that moment, he has nobody. Now, he has his own community in the hospital, you know, and they're equally kind of sparky as he is.
And a lovely relationship with Mrs. Beacon.
Well, I kind of was very moved when that happened. She had this little cat that I didn't really expect called Toddy Ray. And at the same time, like a lot of these people that you pass by, and it's very current in the news now, you pass by these people and you think, you know, how did they get there? Usually, the most ordinary looking of people have incredibly layered experience to which we may or may not be privy. And Mrs. Beacon, who the charlady in the hospital, it turns out when she does reveal a little layer of herself, she worked in a hospital, as a lot of women of that generation did during the war, and had three or four boyfriends, went to the West End, and were very kind of spruce and, you know, talk about feminism. These people had a great sense of themselves, which was given to them by, unfortunately, a world war.
Right.
And then denied again, but it certainly was there in that at that time. And Mrs. Beacon, you know, she kind of, when people, I think, what happens is you don't realise till you get older yourself, you think people are, you know, whether they're conservative or they're actually so preoccupied with their own sadnesses and their own illnesses and their own struggles. They're not interested in these huge, big, seismic revolutions of the world. They have got other things to do. And, you know, they're dealing with loss and bereavement. And that's what Mrs. Beacon represents. She's got a little cat called Toddy Ray, because he likes fish called Ray. And you know, she's these three chins that keep wobbling all at the same time whenever Francie. So he's constantly doing this, kind of almost like he doesn't want to admit the desolation of soul. That's the way out of it.
Right. But at one stage when she says, "Ah, love," he's just so moved because nobody has said, "Ah, love."
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Actually, when you're talking about the women, big brains, the professor, in love with the woman, goes off to New York, very flash, you know, staying in posh places and going up to see a really important match up in Yankee Stadium, I think it was. And she comes on to him and he gets her put into an asylum.
And the impulse perhaps nowadays is to destroy him. But every, you know, bullet, every... he destroys himself because of his own shame, and he knows he's committed a grievous sin. The woman said to us that she loved him. She was expressing herself physically and he hadn't the moral courage. That's what that was. It was about a lack of moral courage, which was very prevalent in the Ireland of the 30s, 40s and 50s, you know. And it was certainly what everyone is saying about women, that every word of that is true. But it was true at all levels, right, of people not having the moral courage. And you see, it's easy for me to say that. You know, it's very hard to stand out from the crowd. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, if you read about something, say, like the Rose Tattoo scandal in the 1950s, you know, and say, how could that ever happen? There were eminent writers who were afraid to go down there because Archbishop John Charles McQuaid would have, you know, brought...
Got all scratchers.
I'm afraid he would, yeah.
Yeah. Last piece of music, and you know where time goes. We can hear that now.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving. But how can they know? Time for them to go.
Sandy Denny.
The incomparable, fragrant songbird. I remember seeing her photograph on the Fairport Convention album where she's standing, it's called Unhalf Bricking. And her parents are standing, I didn't realise it was their parents, that's why it's significant in this book, outside the garden gate. But inside are all the hippie troop, you know, with their floppy hats and their beads and everything else. And these two figures are in their 60s, you know, probably the father fought in the war and the mother was a kind of women's guild type of. And here was a world beyond their garden gates of which they had absolutely no comprehension. You know, and to get back to the robins and snowdrops, you see Sandy with her beautiful long blonde hair, and you could imagine her going to her Wimbledon primary school gathering snowdrops, you know, or maybe a picnic with her mother listening to a robin. And now, where has she gone? And they're and I didn't understand at that age, you know. I remember reading somewhere about, I was talking about the collective kind of tendency of the hippie era. An old brigadier saying, oh, you lot, you're sitting there in Brixton with your collective ideals and your open marriages. Oh, it's been tried before, it didn't work then, and it bloody well won't work now. And thinking he was a fool and everything. And then Sandy Denny dies at 30, 31. And you think, well, what do you say to that? I mean, what I was thinking about was the parents, you see, and because being in a situation like that myself, what that would do to you. And it's like anything in art, you know, a lot of the time it's nobody's fault. Like they say in a really good play, everybody can give an account of what their view of the world is. So that, therein lies the tragedy, and if fiction means anything, whether it's Philip Larkin or David Lynch or my humble efforts, is to try and create some kind of harmony out of that.
Well, I'm just going to a piece from the end, the closing pages. It goes into somebody in a relationship where there are no limbs, no hands, no arms. For what in the end does any of us want? Only contentment, as Father Ron always says. Small measure of satisfaction, that's all, Frank. And which I'm delighted to be able to say in my own life has been the case, against all the odds, I suppose you might say. It's a little bit of redemption there.
Yeah, he's not beyond it. But again, that's up to the reader to decide, you know, because he's not entirely truthful, as you know.
I know, I know. He can be very misleading. Anyway, it is an amazing read, and thank you very... Hey, by the way, since you're a border boy, are you sick and tired of Brexit? Are you angry about
Brexit?
No,
I'm not angry. I don't think anger does anything for anybody. This book says anything that is of no value. It never has been any value. There are two sovereign, indefeasible nations that are going to work this through somehow, and it will happen.
Okay. Caller was on to say, marvellous interview, Marion, with Pat McCabe. So lovely to hear such reflective radio. And that comes from Kathleen. And somebody else saying, great to hear Pat McCabe. I remember he did a show which featured the late Big Tom. But you were always into that. Some people singing the praises of Butcher Boy. Really enjoyed that flow of words from Pat McCabe and much more beside Pat. Thank you very, very much indeed. Good luck with her. The book is called, I must remind you, The Big Yarrow, Patrick McCabe, and it is published next week, basically.
Thank you very much indeed, Maria.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a break.